You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. These were translated by Matthew Barton. There's 15 lectures given in Dornach between the 3rd of October and the 15th of November, 1919. Lecture 1, given in Dornach on the 3rd of October, 1919. Many very diverse points of view have recently been expressed here in Switzerland, too, about the relationship that exists between the anthroposophically oriented spiritual science we have been cultivating in our circles for years, and has led to the construction of this very building, the Goetheanum, and, on the other hand, our efforts, ultimately, to engage with contemporary social movements, our striving to realize something in society and the world, our need to complement anthroposophic endeavors with these social endeavors, has met with the most varied responses, both dismissive and welcoming. Such reactions cannot, of course, be the determining factor in the way we pursue our aims. And yet we do also need to look at various realities that have emerged in this context. Anthroposophists often say that our movement ought not to have burdened itself with what is implicit in the movement for a threefold social organism. And on the other hand, some of those whose interest has been awoken for this social movement find it troubling that this idea began with an anthroposophic outlook, which they may often feel to be obscurely mystical and lacking in clarity. Thus, social threefolders are often criticized by anthroposophists, and anthroposophists by social threefolders. The area of commonality between them is sometimes a bone of contention for both sides. As I say, this cannot lead us astray, but it is important to be fully aware of this state of affairs and keep remembering the inner connection between both outlooks, which we have often had cause to highlight in our reflections here. But there is another thing that has increasingly become apparent, something which may have still greater bearing on our task. You see, ultimately, if sociologists censure any commonality with anthroposophists, there's nothing we can do about it. Just as little as when anthroposophists assert it would have been better not to saddle ourselves with ideas about society. There's nothing much to be done about that either, except pursue our path unerringly, since we have recognized it to be right. But more urgent for our consideration, perhaps, is that there are more and more people saying that an anthroposophic foundation is needed for them to understand the idea of threefolding. The threefold social organism would be much better understood, they say, from an anthroposophic perspective. And this anthroposophic foundation is increasingly being called for precisely in proletarian circles. This is something that may surprise people, although it isn't really all that surprising. The way our friends pursued anthroposophic endeavors in the past, also determined by differences of class, made it difficult to introduce anthroposophy into proletarian circles. But now it is unavoidable that anyone who engages with threefolding also hears something about anthroposophy, becomes at least outwardly acquainted with it. And in fact, it is very remarkable that this is creating a lively need for anthroposophy. In Stuttgart, for instance, After disseminating the idea of social threefolding for a period, without referring to anthroposophy as such, we found it necessary to give lecture series on purely anthroposophic subjects. There were well-founded reasons why this became necessary, and these series are continuing still. We should take particular note of this here and today, by way of introduction. It is really only this that I want to impress on you. Here in Switzerland, we are in a very particular position as regards both these orientations, the social impulse and the impulse, which for us at least is connected with it, of anthroposophy. The question of social endeavors, born out of anthroposophic thinking, is actually very different for Central Europe from the way it appears to us here in Switzerland. In Central Europe, it is a matter of life or death, the life or death of national culture and tradition. There may be many today who do not realize the gravity of the situation, but the life or death of national culture is at stake. When they hear something like this, people think far too superficially. If you say, quote, the death of national culture, close quote, they think it completely exaggerated. Well, you can't kill off 80 million people in a short time, they say. So how can we be facing the demise of national culture? But this is to entirely misunderstand what is at stake. Naturally, 80 or 90 million people are not going to be killed off all of a sudden. But the death of culture means something quite different. We need only recall that when Jerusalem was destroyed, it wasn't just a matter of the death of individual Jews living there, but of the death of a culture, which can happen in a quite different way from how it did there. It really is true to say that this is a life or death question, and that life will only prevail if we begin to create a threefold social order. If this were not so, one could easily regard social threefolding in some other light. But here we are truly facing an either-or situation in the near future, either developing understanding of threefolding or the death of culture. People may hear this and think it immodest or even absurd, and yet it is so. There are good reasons why circumstances compel us to resort to threefolding. We may have more time or less, but there are compelling reasons. In Eastern Europe, likewise, this region that has been indescribably downtrodden by its karma. Things are different here. Here there still is, and potentially will be, a chance to resort to something like threefolding out of free will. Here, you see, as in the West, it is not a matter of life or death, so much as the continuation of events in either a more spiritual or an unspiritual manner. In Switzerland and in the West, we can pursue life materialistically for long periods without any spiritual impulse. Or alternatively, out of our own free will, we can come to see in an eminently spiritual movement, such as threefolding, something essential for providing a new impulse. We do not need to think in terms of life or death. Well, it makes a great difference whether we undertake something out of free will or by compulsion, in an unfree way. In fact, it would signify something entirely different for the world's whole evolution if people in a place like Switzerland were to form the free resolve to embrace the threefolding movement. It is extremely difficult nowadays, even for me, to formulate and express these things objectively. I believe that it would be a great blessing if someone in the West, especially someone in a neutral country, were to find the courage to say this in unadorned fashion. It would signify something quite different in the public domain. In particular, the following should be considered. Whatever came from the few countries that have remained neutral would have the greatest significance, also in an inner sense. If the threefolding impulse could proceed from a country that has stayed neutral in the recent conflicts, this would be a deed of great significance in world history. To comprehend this is already an anthroposophic matter. You see, we can only say what integration of such an impulse into all human evolution would mean if we draw on anthroposophy. And it does matter if this impulse is simply formulated in abstract form or emerges from particular realities, whether it proceeds from the fact of free discernment or emerges from necessities, as it can only do in Central Europe, since at present nothing can arise there except through bitterest calamity. So specifically here in Switzerland, it seems to me, we should view the idea of the social organism and its threefolding with enthusiasm. But then a question becomes pressing. How do we surmount a particular dilemma? Some among you here have been participating in our anthroposophic movement for rather a long time, and have been able to observe how quickly or slowly, and it is usually slowly, the intentions of this anthroposophic movement penetrate human souls. This takes its time. And if it were necessary for people to become anthroposophists first, in order to think in the right way about society, it might well be far, far too late. For this reason, we must think of putting the idea of threefolding as such out into the world, even if it then appears to have less sure foundations. Because we can't afford to wait until anthroposophically oriented thinking has become a matter of course. But then this threefolding idea will need a certain kind of support. Since it won't get this from a real spread of anthroposophy, which takes its time, it must be supported by the presence and engagement of members of the anthroposophic movement. In other words, members of the anthroposophic movement should try to elicit trust through their social conduct and activities. This is at least a question that cannot be resolved theoretically, but only practically, through life itself, since it is a question of our manner and demeanor. We must try to represent social thinking in a way that elicits trust from others, even if it is not possible to create an anthroposophic foundation quickly enough. You will ask how this can be done. How can you develop the right tact as you work to promote the social movement? Again, this cannot be answered categorically. But there is something that will help if given enough consideration. Every individual here, amongst us, should try increasingly to familiarize himself with the nature of the social movement in a real and living way. That this was lacking was evident in our circles when attempts were first made to launch a kind of social movement. Amongst the most well-meaning of our members, amongst the most benevolent adherents of our anthroposophically oriented spiritual scientific movement, were really quite a few who had slept through the modern social movement that arose in the second half of the 19th century and through into our own times. I don't mean they were all unaware that a social movement existed, but it's not enough to know this theoretically or to read about such things in the papers. Instead, one needs to be really familiar with the utterances and aspirations of this movement. Not that long ago, I met people in our midst who, as the threefolding movement began, did not know that unions existed or what they are. We've become too used to passing people by and not concerning ourselves with what they are actually doing, their actual lives. We must learn to really concern ourselves with human souls, to show real interest in them. And here there is a great hindrance, which, without wishing to offend anyone, I would term middle-class benevolence, toward the working class. This middle-class benevolence toward the workers, often, as it were, dripping with social impulses, is actually a serious obstacle to modern social effectiveness. We have seen what I mean here in the most varied spheres. Think of how the people, in quotes, have been portrayed to us in historical novels, popular novels, by authors who understand nothing about ordinary folk, Berthold Auerbach and such like. We have been shown the nature of ordinary people in a kind of theoretical engagement with them. The middle classes consider themselves to be engaging with the social question when they watch, say, Gerhard Hauptmann's title, The Weavers. Well, certainly this play does portray the misery of the masses. It shows them surviving by eating a dead dog. But it is an odd way to understand the nature of society if we watch a poor family eating a dog on stage and then return home to our usual pleasant supper. I'm not saying we can bridge the class divisions in society by tomorrow morning, but we can at least get a real sense for what's happening instead of just passing people by and not knowing the circumstances they live in. It is very important that every individual today should be able to summon before his mind's eye, EYE, a broad world historical panorama. One that only becomes apparent if we look back to former times that have left certain social residues still existing today. And look as well at new things that are erupting through the surface of life, as though from primordial depths into modern society. One question that repeatedly surfaces when people are talking about modern society is the question of organization. Our ways of life have become complex. Division of labor has increasingly come to the fore, so that an individual works within a narrow sphere of activity. We can only work and act as modern people through and within organizations. Organizations have always existed, but no account is taken of the fact that organizations in the old days were quite different from those that now must arise. Nowadays, almost all our organizations perpetuate the old as well as already encompassing new elements, and are in continual upheaval. But so far, an awareness is lacking that must allow something radically new to erupt from the depths of humanity's evolution to its surface. Older forms of organization were really governed by human blood, by blood relations. Looking back to olden times, we see tribal and extended familial groupings, things belonging together and organized by the blood principle rising from human depths. This meant that organization was something largely unconscious, not surfacing fully into awareness. People were involved in organizing themselves, but this didn't become fully conscious. Higher spirits aided human beings in this organizing activity. Today we face the need to accomplish consciously ourselves what once occurred unconsciously, that is, largely by virtue of higher powers than the human. We must work together in associations, in organizations to sustain society. The blood ties between people are gradually losing their meaning. The observed and recognized aim and concern, the objective, must provide the basis for this associative activity. Unconscious or subconscious confederacy must give way to conscious and intentional association. At present, we live in the midst of an interplay of these two streams, conscious and unconscious organization, and the convulsions in society today are very much connected with the confluence of these two currents. Just consider for a moment the efforts of socialist parties of all shades today. In them lives a certain impetus toward conscious organization, albeit as yet instinctive. People want to organize themselves. But on the other hand, they have not yet found the objective that provides a foundation for this conscious organizing activity. If you want to understand this, just look at the primal phenomenon of modern social striving. Let's assume someone stood up here, let's be clear and honest about this, and said, quote, "We must endeavor to work socially," close quote. What would he mean by this? He would mean that this effort should be undertaken here, in Switzerland. If you were to suggest that he should think differently, he would, of course, take offense. Or, imagine someone standing up in France and saying the same thing. He would be speaking of social endeavors within French borders. It has also been stated, theoretically, that socialist programs should use the old national borders as a framework for great socialist cooperatives or collectives. But the state is a residue from the old groupings based on blood relationship. In other words, socialist programs today seek only to impose something new, put something different on top of the same old blood affinities. It is asking a lot for people today to think clearly about such matters. People simply won't be able to do this without becoming anthroposophists. However strange this may sound, it is true to say that people won't be able to think clearly about these things. A call is sounding across the globe today, freedom for the people. In other words, the old blood relationships, originating in long-gone times, should somehow be reorganized. Freedom for the people. But this trumpet call, resounding through the world, completely overlooks the nature of conscious organization. This is how greatly things clash in our time. In fact, only truly universal anthroposophic insight into human nature will lead us where we need to go. But there's a long way to go to achieve this. Anthroposophic and particularly theosophic ideas, as they were, have always been stumped by this question. Yes, indeed, people said that we need brotherly understanding of human beings without distinction of race, color, and so forth. But has this become a reality in our era? No, it has become theoretical, abstract, not real. And at present, it is least real of all. And in consequence, these anthroposophic and theosophic endeavors have been drawn into a general love for the abstract, which we have so often discussed here, a general love of abstraction that lives in thinking and feeling capacities that sunder themselves from life. As modern people today, we live a life we ought not to live, a double life. On the one hand, life in outer work, our profession and various other things resembling or relating to it, and then a life of thinking and feeling. A workaday life and a Sunday life, if you like. When someone speaks of the Spirit, we don't really care to hear this intervening in our Monday to Saturday existence. Talk of the Spirit, we think, belongs to the Sunday sermon, which we can enjoy in its separate and distinct place, when we don't have to remember the business of the week. Then, and only then, we can feel a certain pleasure when we hear about fraternity, neighborly love, and so on. This double life extends into science, and here we must see the historical causes of it clearly. You see, our mundane academic disciplines no longer allow themselves to speak of the soul, let alone the spirit. It is thought perfectly self-evident that they should not. Academics today tell us that science must be free of belief, and in saying this, they think that they serve unprejudiced science. They say that anything connected with soul or spirit will constrain and hamper scientific inquiry, since such matters are decided only by subjective faith or that is what they believe. But what is this due to in reality? In fact, in our era, religious faiths and confessions have, as it were, monopolized the soul and spirit for themselves. And nowadays the view that anthroposophy should not be cultivated is regarded as quite self-evident, that science must be free of such taints and should have nothing to say about soul or spirit, since that is a domain monopolized by the confessions. Academics proclaim that science must be, in quotes, objective, and therefore refrain from engaging with matters of the soul or spirit, since this will violate rules of scientific exactitude. It is very humorous, really. Forgive me for speaking of humor in such a serious concern. But there is such a thing as serious humor. Sometimes the tragi-comic is more important for the world's development than the purely tragic or merely comic. It is humorous to hear academics discourse in this way, since it is actually due to the fact that they were forbidden for long periods to speak of spirit and soul. Those who today believe they should keep science untainted by faith for the sake of its exactitude are unaware this purity results from a dogma that prohibited them from thinking about soul and spirit. What academics proclaim as the dictates of exact science is the deposit and residue of the old ecclesiastical ban. People are simply unaware of this, of the historical antecedents to what they announce and proclaim as a self-evident and, sometimes in their view, lofty truth. But we should wake up to this, not sleep through it, and without doing so we won't get anywhere. However fine our declarations about the social question, we will get nowhere if we give ourselves up to illusions about the greatest lie that exists, the scientific lie of the modern era. As yet we do not have a real feeling of this lie in science, but we must learn to feel it. What I have just said is not intended emotionally, but entirely theoretically, and can only be properly understood in its theoretical intentions. You see, I only feel obliged to speak of the scientific lie, in quotes, because as much as I unreservedly criticize modern science from this point of view, at the same time, I defend it equally staunchly. Science became great by virtue of the very fact that people only focused on the physical, corporeal realm for a period, and no longer concerned themselves much with soul and spirit. But we should only regard this as a principle of utility and as a pedagogical principle in humanity's evolution, and not as something of fundamental intrinsic value. Today it should be realized that the mundane sciences need once again to be imbued with real knowledge of the soul and spirit. This alone will give rise to vigorous engagement with social problems. In our time, it is necessary for people to start to perceive and discern things differently from the way recognized in our schools. There are matters of knowledge and discernment that are now becoming incumbent upon us in a way that for a long period they were not. The Copernican worldview was entirely sufficient for a long time. It was useful for people to conceive of the cosmos in these neat terms. Here the sun, around which the earth orbits in an ellipse, and around the earth the moon orbits in turn, and then between sun and earth we have Mercury, Venus, and Mars, further off, and so on. It was very neat to have this whole picture of the movements of the planets in ellipses round the sun. Humanity found this perfectly sufficient until now. But what were the historical origins of this picture? I have often referred to this. Historically, it arose when the great Copernicus wrote his book about the revolution of the planets, at the beginning of which we find three key principles. If all three are considered, that's fine. But they were not all given due weight. Only the two first principles were taken up, while the third was overlooked. The first two give us the Copernican system, as later elaborated by Kepler and Newton. But unfortunately, this system is not correct. If, in the calculation of this system, a particular planet is supposed to occupy a particular position, and you direct your telescope to where it ought to be, you find it is not there. The system says it should be, but it isn't. This is why people have been using, quote, Bessel's reduction, close quote, or, quote, Bessel's correction, close quote, for a long time now, to correct the calculation. You direct the telescope not to the point you should, according to the Copernican system, but to the point established after you have corrected the calculation. What are these Bessel's corrections exactly? What do they mean? They signify the need to always apply anew something one would apply only once and for all, if proper account were taken of all three Copernican laws, instead of ignoring the third. But if we do include this third law of Copernicus, then in turn the whole picture, with the planets revolving round the sun, no longer works so neatly at all. And we have to conceive a different cosmic system. In fact, people will not conceive this different picture of the cosmos until they have been properly prepared to think differently by anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. You see, how do people look at the world nowadays? They look at it as if they were sitting in a railway carriage, but never looking out of the window or alighting from the train, just sitting inside and living with the other passengers. In fact, you can travel for a while then, when the train stops, get out, and visit a town or city to see what is there, then perhaps board another train and travel further to another town and do the same again. These are stages of experiences, and you carry them with you. But modern astronomers see the passage of the Earth through the cosmos as if they were sitting in a railway carriage, never alighting, and experiencing nothing but the other passengers. You might ask how one could stop the world and get off. Is this possible? Well, you can, actually, though it is different from getting out of a train. To alight from a train, you depart through the carriage door and head off in some direction. To alight from the earth means to go inward, into the soul. If you really penetrate into the soul, you come to what lives within the soul, and you have alighted from the earth. In relation to the earth, you have undertaken the same procedure as alighting from a train and boarding it again. But the remarkable thing here is that when alighting in this way, that is, going deeply within in contemplation, not in an illusory but a real tangible way, you experience something different each time you do so, something really different each time. Mystical professions of finding God in the soul through inner contemplation are declamatory statements. Really experiencing something inwardly, it turns out, is different in different eras, an ever-renewed and different experience. Why so? Because we experience the cosmos when we do this, always a different place in the cosmos. The ancients discovered their system of the heavens through such inward experience rather than through purely outward observation. The Copernican system, on the other hand, arose by a mode of experience that resembles sitting in a train carriage. The system of the cosmos in future will have to become inner experience once more, a journey through inward experiences. And this will give rise to a different picture. Above all, we will learn to experience the world in a tangible way, rather than through the abstract cognition so prevalent today. Something curious and actually very pleasing happened to me in Berlin recently. Not long ago, a squalid piece appeared in the German journal Die Hilfe, entitled False Prophet. Such articles are read and forgotten. But a few weeks back, when I was in Berlin, an American visited me and told me he had come to see me because he had read this article and reckoned that such a diatribe must mean there was something interesting afoot. This only by way of introduction to what actually pleased me, which was a question the man posed, a very apt question. He said he had quickly understood what was involved in threefolding of the social organism, but he wanted to ask this: do you think that this threefolding of the social organism is an eternal truth, which, once discovered, will create social conditions that hold sway forevermore? Or is it a truth that applies to a particular time, which will eventually give way to something else? I was very struck that one could still find people today who show such insight, who do not believe in millenarianism, in some thousand-year Reich, in some absolute, single, and never-to-be-questioned truth that applies uniformly, ubiquitously, and for all time. Socialist thinkers believe that the socialist state must be realized tomorrow, and once it has been established, it will never have to change. I replied to him as follows: naturally, people have striven for a unified state in recent centuries. But now we have got to the point where we need to structure this state in a threefold way. After a further period, something else will come, a synthesis, and in turn the opposite will inevitably appear. You see, it is not always so comfortable to have to engage with actual specifics and real conditions. It is not as easy as working out an absolute system. But it is necessary to deal with specific conditions today, to be aware that what we must create is something that accords with the current situation in the world. This can already be understood today in terms of astronomy, in quotes, by seeing, for instance, that mystical experiences vary depending on whether they occur in one or another decade or century, and that we can observe the actual movements of the earth, experience them mystically within us. But today the, quote, great astronomical principle, close quote, must be seen and felt in relationship to society, to social realities. We need to develop the capacity to progress by going beyond a stage that bears only an outward parallel to stages of former times, in that they too were not only transitional stages, but impulses for evolution. Think of the ancient Greeks. They inhabited a particular region extending as far as the Pillars of Heracles. Within those confines, the earth was specific and tangible for them. Beyond that was only vagueness and generality. The Greeks had a regional consciousness. Then the modern era arrived, the discovery of America, the voyages to the East Indies, and such like. Earthly consciousness arose. The regional consciousness of the Greeks became our modern global awareness. Just as everything further than the Pillars of Heracles was vague and undiscerned for the Greeks, so today, everything that goes beyond earthly consciousness is indeterminate for us, merely mathematical fantasy, Galilean or Newtonian fantasy. Such fantasy must be replaced by realities. We have to transform Earth consciousness into cosmic consciousness, in the same way that the regional or national consciousness of the Greeks was transformed into global consciousness of the whole Earth. That is where we are today, at this point. And we will make no social progress unless we find a way to elaborate the cosmic consciousness of the future from the earthly consciousness of today. Unless we develop, through the teachings of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, the great astronomical world picture of what lies beyond us in the cosmos, we will not comprehend the truth of the cosmos. And if we do not do so, we cannot become citizens of the cosmos. But we will not become social citizens either, until we become conscious citizens of the cosmos. The end of Lecture 1.